Thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward, and today we're going to be talking about Threat Horizon 2024, the annual ISF look at the dangers, issues, and technology innovations that are going to be troubling InfoSec teams over the next few years. The latest edition of that report was released to ISF members recently, and this is going to be the first in a series of podcasts exploring its themes, its threats, and the way it characterizes the world. With me today is Paul Watts, who was at CISO for 16 years before joining the ISF as a distinguished analyst. And also with us is Max Brooks, one of the analysts in the research team, who before he joined the ISF completed an MA at King's College on Intelligence and International Security. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm good. So just to start things off, I wanted to talk about my experience with Threat Horizon because I was lead author on the 2023 report and 2024, ably assisted by other people at the ISF both times. And for the 2023 report, the way we characterized the world and certainly the way we sort of angled a lot of our predictions and a lot of the text was that we assumed that the pandemic would, in some respects, by the cover date of the report 2023, would be petering out and that there would be a return to normality. And certainly some of the advice we put in the report was to do with how to claw back some of that normality and get back to those good old times when things were predictable, controllable, and you had your system set up and your policies in place, etc. And certainly with 2024, the report and the way the world, we characterize the world, that is just not going to happen. And it's clear that we're, you know, whatever the pandemic is doing to us is here to stay. That turmoil, that chaos and uncertainty is only going to roll on. And certainly by 2024, it's probably not going to be as dissipated anything like as much as we thought. So, I mean, that's the backdrop to this. Just my experience is that it's very much, it's a very different beast and the world is going to look very different as well. But Paul, just to, if you could give us a sense as well, because as a CISO, I guess you were a consumer user of Threat Horizon, call it what you will. But you've been inside the ISF now, you've seen, lifted the bonnet, lifted the hood, looked underneath, poked at the engine for it. Just has your view of it changed? You can be as critical as you like, but I'd be curious about that.
Now, well, look, CISOs tend to spend a lot of their time worrying in real time, putting out fires, being very, very reactionary. And you know, we know that we need to be thinking more strategically and looking out to the future. You know, COVID is the gift that keeps on giving. You know, we all thought at first this was going to be a 4-week thing, then a 2-month thing, then a 6-month thing. And here we are 2 years later, and it's still the bane of our lives. You know, we're starting to see a sense of normality now. It's interesting, the conversations that I've been having with security leaders when I'm saying, should we talk about three years out? And I said, 3 years? I'm worrying about the next 3 weeks. And it's been really, really interesting to see where people's minds are. But what I like about Threat Horizon, and I have used it, you know, in the past to engage conversations with the board, is to really start to get them thinking about the future and say, look, wouldn't it be nice if we thought about the future threat landscape now rather than wait for us to be hit by something and then have to react to it? Wouldn't that be great? So I've used Threat Horizon to great effect. I think where it becomes quite interesting, and maybe we can talk about this during the series, Mark, is getting the context to your own organisation. So it's great talking about a theoretical T+3 year threat, but you've got to think about that in the context of your own organisation before you go into conversation with your board. Because whilst we all get quite excited about worrying about future threats, that's not how they think. So you've got to kind of make it real to them. And I learned that lesson, I think, the first time I took Threat Horizon. You know, I went in very, very vanilla and they went, this is really great, Paul. So what?
Yeah, the next step for it. And certainly just writing Threat Horizon, looking ahead, was quite nice because, again, I mean, I don't share that experience as a CISO, but just the pandemic has just anchored everybody in every day, the day-to-day grind of how do I have to deal with today? And raising our gaze a bit, extending our horizons, looking a bit further out was quite nice. I mean, it was a nice break from the rather grim news and all the chaos that was, you know, embroiling us in all our lives. So yeah, it's been nice in that respect, but certainly for any CISO the last couple of years, it must have been hellish because you must have asked a lot of their teams and there's a lot of transformation happened, some of it good. And like I say, it's a gift in some respects that has given to organizations, but equally, you know, it's a bit of a poison pill too sometimes. Max, just wanted to quiz you a bit about your experience with Threat Horizon because, you know, after doing that MA, looking at international relations, having a much better sense of world politics and than probably most folks in the research team. I'm just curious about sort of your how you approached it and sort of the different different aspects that InfoSec practitioners want as opposed to, I guess, the audience you were writing for when you're doing your MA.
Yeah, well, I think from my MA, I kind of became pretty familiar with the idea of forecasting and prediction from the more human side. So either looking at individuals or state actors or, you know, wider sort of state policy, and jumping into Threat Horizon, what my initial perception was to be moving that sort of skill set to primarily a technology sort of focus. So whether that's looking at some of the cloud or ransomware or the hacktivism. And I think what I kind of personally started to understand as we went kind of through the process was that actually it wasn't quite as a binary difference between the more human side from looking at international security and intelligence to jumping straight over to the other side in terms of technology. Actually, these worlds are pretty similar. And I think increasingly as technology continues to evolve and it becomes more pervasive in terms of its interaction with our everyday life, that sort of barrier and that line between this human and the technology side is actually starting to become more blurred. And I thought that was where some of the more interesting sort of nuggets and bits of information started to pop out and actually started to give us some of those threads that you could pull on a bit more to kind of entice out some of those, you know, potentially some of the more difficult and harder to answer questions, but which I think, especially looking forward to 2024, will be even more important.
I was going to ask a question about that. It's interesting that you say that, and I think we talked about this during the research, but do you, because we've now got that tight coupling of technology and society, do we think society is actually capable of adapting at the speed that technology adapts? And do we still see that as a point of potential conflict? I'd be really interested in your views on that, Max, having seen it from both sides.
Yeah, I think from kind of my perception that I've understood is that there's probably kind of a little bit of a lack of a real understanding of where that line is. And also in terms of its effects and impacts is that, you know, technology is racing away and perhaps our understanding or our ability to manage this and to sort of keep it in an area or a box per se of where we want it to be is actually maybe not quite in the position that we think it is. And I think that's going to be something that's going to kind of create some frictions and some challenges looking forward, especially, 2024 and beyond, that we're going to have some pretty difficult conversations and questions asked about, you know, where this is and where the reality lies and where we want it to be.
Yeah, so because I think that's the fascinating thing about Threat Horizon and just that this research generally is that often with Threat Horizon, you're looking for that next new innovation because you want to try and predict the strange things people will do with it. And you always get that wrong because people find their own uses for these kinds of things. And I think InfoSec is a very optimistic trade in that, you know, it would, because you set a lot of things up and you ask people, you hope that people will follow the rules and processes that you set up, but actually they find their own way to do it. And the other side of InfoSec is coping with what people eventually do with these technologies. And certainly with Threat Horizon this year, it's all about that difficult interaction. Just the themes we picked out, just the, you know, whether it's the technology choices that organizations make, the way that regulators are trying to control some of this stuff and how that might squeeze it in different directions. And then just fundamentally, just how every business now is afloat on a sea of data, and just how they cope with that and just what it does to their customers, what it does to their business relations. And that's definitely a big step forward that I'm glad we did pick out in 2024, that just that technology is intrinsic to everything, just all the places, all the time.
I just don't think we learn the lessons, though. I mean, I've been particularly fascinated about the research that you did, Mark, with regulations of artificial intelligence, for example. We've kind of been here before. You know, Facebook came along and people found their way with it and then realised that not only was it a force for good, it was a force for evil. We looked to our lords and masters to show us the way through legal and regulatory advice in terms of, you know, what were the rules of the playground? And it turned out that there weren't any. And what's really, really interesting, fascinating and scary at the same time is when we now start to see a more pervasive use of artificial intelligence and machine learning, we just don't have
a decent regulatory landscape or any sort of moral and ethical compass, let's call it that, to make sure that we're getting that appropriate balance right, so society can get to grips with this new technology. And I do wonder now whether, you know, thinking through the moral and ethical lens, where, you know, we talk about shift left in security, you know, we say we should think about the pros and the cons and the ramifications of doing something digitally before we embark on doing it. Well, surely we've now got to take that up 2, 3, maybe 4 notches to say, before we embark in some of these massive changes, artificial intelligence, metaverse, and so on and so forth, we've really got to think long and hard about what this means to this society, because we are all learning and adapting to these new technologies at different rates of speed, are we not?
Yeah, I think so, because I read something very interesting recently about that tried to make sense of what China is doing to a lot of its tech giants. Because to a Western point of view, it's baffling, because it looks like they're hobbling them, that they're trying to stop them doing what they're doing well and is what earning those organizations a lot of money. However, China clearly does not buy into that Western civilization aspect, which says that, yeah, you should succeed at all costs. And China is much more interested in, you know, that basic fundamental, what is this doing to our society and what do we want it to do for our society? And that's why they're trying to manipulate, massage things in that direction. Whereas, you know, in a lot of other places, it's just like, let them get on with it and we'll cope with the consequences once we see what they are.
Do you think that geopolitics is going to provide enough of a fragmentation for us globally to not be able to have that level set? How are we going to navigate our way through that? You know, different cultures and the way different, you know parts of the planet think and feel are different. You know, they are incompatible with each other. We've seen that with GDPR. You know, the Europeans have really taken a hard line on there, and that's not in confluence with other parts of the world. We're always going to have this problem, right? And I just wonder what that means in the longer term.
I think it's going to be, yeah, just for a lot of organizations, it's going to be a very difficult place to do business, because, you know, we saw this certainly in the 2023 report, that there was a lot of the initial effects of the pandemic were to fracture a lot of those international relationships. Regulations short-term came in terms of trade, and then I've seen the impacts on supply chains and things like that as well. So wanting to run a seamless organization across the world, forget that now. It's just not going to happen, and it's only going to get worse, because like you say, there's the bigger technology movements, AI, machine learning, etc. Lots of governments are really worried about those for all kinds of reasons, and they're just going to want to clamp down on them. But they don't have particularly good ideas about how they should be managed. And that's just going to, because I think the OECD has a list of 60 nations that are developing their own AI based, sorry, regulations on AI and machine learning.
It's going to become an arms race. You know, quantum may well be the same thing. You know, the race for quantum supremacy. You know, whoever's first past the post, do they become the moral arbiter of how that technology should be used? And are we worried about that? You know, what if a nation state that it potentially has motives that are not necessarily in line with you know, somebody else? Is that a problem? Could they weaponize that? You know.
It's a difficult one for sure. But Max, I just wonder if can you think of any historical parallels here, sort of in terms of just, you know, governments getting caught out by the speed of, you know, what organizations are doing at all? I don't know if there's a sort of, because what does strike me is that, and certainly we call this out in the report, that some of the early, and I think you've nodded to this as well, Paul, just that those regulations are not going to do what the regulators think they will, but we don't quite yet know what they will do, and whether that clampdown means organizations just try to get away with whatever the hell they can and cope afterwards and see those fines and other restrictions just the cost of doing business, or whether there's any historical parallels here, any lessons that, you know, that governments have, that they do try this regulation then suddenly step in with a big stick and say, you know what, this needs to stop.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it's difficult to draw some genuine historical parallels, because I think right now we are in sort of a truly uncharted territory in terms of for organizations in order to try and navigate through these different regulatory loopholes and to understand the context in which they sit globally. Because, you know, I think as both of you sort of mentioned earlier, it is kind of often gets lost in terms of when looking globally, and the understanding of geopolitics is just truly how different the world is in terms of ways of life and cultures, but also how these then filter in just to business practices and how individuals and states and organizations just approach, you know, from everything from the minutiae of every day in the office to some of the bigger strategic questions. So I think it's going to be a challenge, and I think organizations are going to have to be savvy to understand and to really be in tune with where they're operating in, not only in terms of the regulations and ensuring that they're in line with these, but also understanding why these regulations, you know, perhaps are in place, and understanding that these aren't just simply, you know, a set of rules that are put up, you know, regarding where you are in the world, but these are actually reflective of, as you mentioned with China, of just a different approach to business and a different way of conducting every day, and sort of the end goal is always going to be different where you are. So I think, yeah, I wish there was something I could draw on now, but I think it's just so novel in terms of for everybody at the moment now, in terms of the connectedness and where this might be in the next few years.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think with China, it has a very definite view on what it wants the technology sector to do for its nation. But it remains to be seen if they're right or if they can achieve what they want. They have a very good, technologically, they're very well set up. And I think ideologically as well, they've probably got some leverage they could use. But the Europe is interesting because they're simply going to ban some approaches like biometrics and AI and things like that. Just you're not going to be able to do that. Or it's going to be so tightly regulated that the benefit organizations could get from it is going to be pretty scant, I would imagine, because it'll be really expensive to do. And if you get it wrong, then the fines are going to be massive and, you know, way higher than you would get with GDPR. But I think you're right. There is a lot of, the world is shattered in some respects, hasn't it? But we are living through unprecedented times. But I just, Paul, as a CISO, I mean, was it, I guess, like you say, if you're firefighting every day, and is it hard to recognize and acknowledge those kinds of things and just get things done?
You spend a lot of your life living in the net. I mean, the number of times I've kind of, you know, reflected after a hard day's graft at the office and thought, I'm not really in control here. But actually, I don't think anybody's really in control. It's one of the things we say in the closing summaries for Threat Horizon 24 is that, you know, we think we're in control of the data. But to be honest with you, you know, the society can't comprehend and process the amount of data and the volumes of data that we generate anymore. You know, we're talking about 175 zettabytes of data being created or replicated by 2025. You know, we can't comprehend that sort of data. Actually, I think the data is kind of controlling us. So it's hard to give yourself the time to kind of think about the ramifications of what's happening in the future. I mean, if you're a CISO working across, you know, multiple time zones and multiple different regions, actually trying to correlate, you know, what is the stance that we want to take, and how is that compatible with the way other parts of the planet think and feel? It's incredibly complicated now. And we talk about trust. You know, trust is the bedrock of the way we operate right now. And we are prophesizing the disintegration of that by 2024. I was reading this morning, obviously the Winter Olympics in Beijing have kicked off, and the Chinese authorities have mandated that everybody has an app installed on their phone to do a multitude of different things. And the immediate response from the feds over in the States, and I'm sure our government had similar sentiments, although I'm not sure what they've said on the record, is take a burner phone out there. Do not connect yourself to those ecosystems. There is a trust issue. So as we go further and further into digital transformation and the data economy grows and grows and grows, we've got a massive problem with trust. Now, I'm conscious I've kind of moved away from the question you originally asked, but I think it's relevant in that we don't have time to think like that, you know, that headspace. And this is where Threat Horizon is really valuable, because, you know, the ISS has kind of gone away and done a little bit of that thinking for you and said, no, this is getting you off the starting block. Now think about this in the context of your own organizations, have the conversations, use the threat radar, and start to try as much as you can to plan for the future. I think in 2024, we're going to start to see a little bit of headspace where we can start to think about future strategy, but we've got 2 years worth of, you know, sticking plasters to kind of unpick. You know, we've done a lot in a very short space of time, not necessarily respecting our own regulatory and policy boundaries. And we've got to make sure that we're set up for the future as well. So it's a unique situation to be looking at. We want to look into the future, but we're struggling. We've got today problems to deal with, and we've got a legacy that, you know, not only have we all got to deal with technical debt, we've got the last couple of years to disrepair as well. That's a perfect storm for our operational CISOs to be working in at the moment. So, you know, anything we can do to kind of help them on their journey is great. But getting the time to think is really challenging.
Yeah, I think your point about trust is well made, because I suspect with, as a CISO, you're looking for as much control as you can get, but you depend on trust, or you trust that people will do what you have, you know, will follow those processes. And I think that's the most pernicious aspect of this report, is just that you can't trust that anymore. And obviously, industry-wise, there's moves towards zero trust type architectures and those kinds of things, where you literally, clues in the name, where you have to try and find another way to reassure yourself that things are trustworthy. And I think that's going to be one of the big changes. And I think, to your point as well, Max, just that local appreciation of what, either socially, where the different lifestyles of people, where organizations trade, just those broader regulatory issues as well, national politics, international politics. I think that's going to be a growing sensibility for a lot of organizations. So there as well, just I think in the report, because there are some bigger things as well, like environmental issues are going to become massive. I think as well, Max, you mentioned those elections looming in 2024, which who knows what kind of impact those are going to have. So there are broader social, big economic, political changes happening as well. So yeah, the world of 2024 is going to be a tricky place. I mean, is that broadly capture it, Max? Just that your organization, though the pandemic will become endemic, there's a lot of other change and turmoil going on in the background that organizations will have to cope with as well.
Yeah, certainly. I think sort of how it came across during some of the research and some of the conversations we had is that there seems to be quite a lot of crossroads coming up now in the future, in every aspect of the personal analysis, whether that's your political crossroad in terms of the elections, because there's quite a few important global ones going to be occurring. So whether we understand which way these might go could completely shift and change, national and international politics and relations, or whether that's a crossroad in terms of some of the more environmental focused issues that are currently facing us. And whether there might be a point, as we mentioned in the analysis, that the globe globally is predicted to have reached or breached the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit set out in the Paris Accord, which I think has come quite a few years prior to what many would have expected. And that in itself is going to be a question and an issue of whether it becomes a genuine point of action, or it continues to be more of a political talking point. But I think what certainly came out, and just to touch on the idea of trust and control, is that it's a very sort of simple concept to understand and to describe when we look at it, the idea of trust on its most basic level, in terms of trust between individuals, whether that be a friend or a family member. But actually, I think when you start to widen that scope and understand and try and assess that idea of trust, whether it's organizational or between governments and individuals, it actually becomes sort of a murkier concept. But I think at its core, it just signifies an idea of dependency and accepting a certain level of risk, in terms of putting the guard down perhaps, and sort of removing and relinquishing that idea of total control, which I think is something that InfoSec professionals will, potentially in the future struggle with even more so. And I think in this personal analysis really draws on that and just sort of demonstrates a level of perhaps guardedness that organizations and individuals might have in the future as this idea of trust on a wider scale actually starts to disintegrate and fall away, that could have some pretty important ramifications.
I'll just pick up on that, and this might be a little bit controversial, but we're all friendly folks, CISOs, honest we are. I think security leaders are going to have to start to think a little bit differently. We've historically been quite binary. Here's a policy, here's a control. This is good. Everything else is bad. I think the speed that everything is, the speed that everything happens now on that agility, there needs to be a bit of lateral movement. There needs to be a little bit of agility. And I think, I think security professionals and security leaders will have to start to think about, you know, what is that wriggle room and that leeway where we just have to accept that we're not necessarily in control. You know, we can be in as much control as we can, but you're never going to be in complete control. And we have to accept that we're relinquishing part of that just because of the speed that everything happens around us and all of the different pests and influences that we have. And I wonder whether, you know, this is kind of the watershed moment where security leaders have to look across the boardroom at CXOs and look back saying, look, we've got to work together, but we've got to recognize that there is conciliation that needs to happen on both sides. And I think that's going to be a bit of a step change in the way that traditional CISOs work with their businesses. And we just have to concede the fact that no matter how hard we try, no matter how hard we want to think we're in control, we will never be in total control. It's just that where is the threshold where it's a runaway mind train versus something that you can ostensibly to an extent control? And it kind of leads you to the question that we left Threat Horizon 2024 on is, do we want to try really, really hard to try and get a model of trust back, model of trust and control, or do we just accept it's gone and we need to think about a different way to operate and counterbalance risk and reward in what is a world that's just shifting and accelerating as every day goes past? And that is a conversation I'm really looking forward to, you know, sitting down with members and shooting the breeze on that, because I don't think anybody's got a great answer. But I think it's something that we all have to face together now if we are going to survive the speed of change on the planet.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because certainly InfoSec has changed a lot because of the pandemic, and a lot of other things have changed because of the pandemic as well. But also, I think relatively few people expect a nice quiet life when they become a CISO. It is a bit of a white knuckle ride. And I think to some extent they have to kind of get used to that. And they have to sort of say, well, if it's working and it's going in the right direction and I've got as much control as I can possibly have, then okay. But it's once it starts to veer off course and things, that's when you need your other processes around it. But yeah, I think it is definitely that white knuckle ride for the next few years. It's tough. And organizations, like I say, have hard choices to make because a lot of things are changing and they have to do different things to be able to survive.
I think a CISO who wants to be a control freak is in for a very harrowing ride over the next few years. And they're going to have to recognize that they need to change. And if they don't change, then I think businesses will probably work more and more to ostracize them. And the tragic irony of that is it means that the might of some of the threats we talk about in Threat Horizon 2024 and in previous years will become more and more pertinent. You know, there are very few things in certainly in the 2024 paper that won't be able to be solved without a collaboration of business and technology, security and risk people working together. And that's really, really important. If that impasse is still there, if the security teams and the risk teams just don't have that strength of relationship with the boards, yeah, I don't think it's going to end particularly well, if I'm honest with you. The time has come for business and security people to work as one, and that requires change on both sides, I'm afraid. But I see it as positive. You know, we see, you know, things like business information security officers coming in now, where you've got people who get security but predominantly focused on the business side. Just bringing those tenets together, I think, is really, really important as we face into, you know, the world in 2024.
Yeah, well, I think one of the good things that came out of 2023 was that, and the report that emerged from that research was that what the pandemic did do in a lot of organizations was get CISOs talking and get CISOs noticed. And, you know, that conversation, those conversations were being had, and often they were crisis rooms and war rooms and day-to-day just managing and trying to cope. But beyond that and through to 2024, hopefully, yeah, that communication, those channels are set up and there is some room for taking the next step. And definitely that's what, you know, unfortunately, Threat Horizon doesn't offer many solutions, but it's got a lot of advice. And I think, like you say, letting CISOs and their contemporaries on boards, etc., wrestle with that question, and at least ask that question, that's definitely a step forward rather than just blinking in the headlights and going, what the hell's going to hit us next?
We did a little bit of work just for Christmas into New Year, and a lot of displacement because of Omicron and so on and so forth. But we're going to get it out in the next few weeks. But one of the things, and Max, keep me honest here because my mind's a bit hazy, is I think CISOs were saying that they enjoyed, if that's the right word, a real strength and bond of relationship with their businesses at time of crisis, right at the start of pandemics when they were trying to, you know, find ways for their organisations to sustain when they were basically decomposed into people working all over the place. But as the pandemic has kind of wore on, we've almost reverted back to type. There is a little bit of enduring strength of relationship there, but some others have kind of reversed back. And is that in line with your recollection of events? And I think that's something that we probably need to build on in the coming months in terms of, you know, how do we mature and strengthen that bond and make it enduring?
Yeah, I think it's certainly something that is worth exploring further and building upon. And I think, certainly some of the inferences I got from some of the research and listening to some of the feedback we had is that, yeah, CISOs, I think in terms of their outlook is almost like the blinkers have come off, that the early pandemic days have sort of the early pandemic days have opened their eyes to the wider business context of their importance and their role, but also in terms of how other factors are increasingly going to, looking forward, be impacting it further and further. Of course, the pandemic is a huge generational event, but it doesn't mean that smaller events on a similar scale can't continue to impact businesses and organizations in a similar kind of way, where actually security professionals and CISOs and leaders are actually going to need to be included in some of that more strategic outlook and more strategic appreciation of actually the value that can be added and the importance of that role going forward.
I think you bang on there, actually. When I talk to peers in the industry, when the proverbial hits the fan, you're hitting a major incident, breach of air, and God forbid, a ransomware event, and so on and so forth, you have this sense of camaraderie. You know, everybody comes together to work the problem, and suddenly, you know, the security teams are useful and valuable, and you can kind of see it there and in the moment. And then you go back to BAU, and there's a little bit of a drains up, and then people kind of go their separate ways, and it's just building on that bit at the end. Prevention is better than cure, honestly. And I think if you want to think like that, it's not about surviving crisis and working well as a team, although that is absolutely and valuable and imperative. It's the bit before and afterwards that generally gets overlooked because, you know, there's more important things to do, you know, worrying about EBITDA, drive the revenue, where's the next meal coming from? But I just think we need to work much more closely to make that an enduring capability. Invest much more time in that beginning and the end, and then that crisis, touch wood, will happen less and less and less. And it's that value creation that I think we've got to build on. And it's definitely an area to explore going forward, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a decent point to end it as well. I suppose the closing thought is that in a lot of organisations, we're all in this together. And I think the pandemic has certainly emphasised that, just that, you know, there's lessons to be learned there, and that communication is key to making sure that, you know, whatever value, positive value there is in the pandemic, that we do appreciate it and work with it. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools and guidance. Thanks for listening.